Watch out for the phone.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. It's Tuesday, April 14th. Got a few things on our agenda. We're going to start out with House Bill 3004 for some public hearing on that bill to accommodate some that are only here for a short time. And then we'll move into House Bill 2784 and come back to 3004 for further comments.
We don't have people here tonight for 2786.
Maybe. If you're here for 2366, that bill is not going to be heard tonight. We're going to repost that bill by the end of the week because we have some amendments that may take a little bit longer than a day or two to get done. So I don't know if I said that earlier, but I should have. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3004. Victoria, give us a brief little summary of 3004, would you please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3004 provides that sale by trustee of foreclosed property or sale of residential property after judicial foreclosure precludes further action against mortgager for deficiencies in amount secured by mortgage, effective on passage.
Thank you. And first up, I think we have Representative Clem and Art and Jane Cummins. If y'all want to come up, that would be great. Representative Clem, welcome to the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21 here in Central and East Salem. Jane is a constituent of mine, and many of you who've been here a while may recognize her from work with the League of Oregon Cities for a number of years. And she and Art met with me this summer and talked to me about a situation that they encountered that you'll hear about, so I won't belabor it. But I spoke with a number of friends of mine who work in the lending industry, and none of them believed me that this happened or was currently legal to allow to occur, the situation. And yet it did, and I think at this point I'll let them tell the story of what occurred and how we might be able to fix this going forward in the future.
Thank you. And if you'd identify yourself for the record before you give your testimony, welcome. Yes.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, and members of the committee who are here. My name is Jane Cummins. Do you need my address?
No.
Okay. All right. I know Art's going to get into the details. I'm just going to give you a few remarks. But I do want to say I believe that we are talking about non-judicial proceedings, nothing to do with judicial proceedings. And I believe that the summary says something about judicial proceedings. Okay. House Bill 3004 closes a loophole to prevent abuse of Oregon's Trust Deed Act. The Trust Deed Act is pro-lender in that trust deeds, in comparison with standard mortgages, eliminate a borrower's right of redemption. The foreclosed property then becomes more marketable. The Act also includes language protecting the borrower from losing more money after foreclosure. However, as pointed out in court cases, which Art Cummins is going to refer to, lenders have been permitted to avoid the constraints through creative financing. House Bill 3004 ensures that if a homeowner defaults on a loan, the lender gets the property and the consumer does not face further indebtedness related to initial purchase of the property. The bill is being introduced because of a situation our daughter and son-in-law find themselves in. And while the bill will not help them, it will help other Oregon home buyers. On a personal note, I believe that the real estate industry has suffered a black eye, in fact, probably two black eyes, because of recent practices. They prey on young families, use best sales techniques to get families into a dream house beyond their actual means, all to make bigger bucks. Add to that a sinking economy, rising unemployment, and a loophole in an Oregon law, and the result is devastating to many Oregon families. So I urge you to support and pass House Bill 3004 out of committee and to clearly state the legislature's intent to protect Oregon's consumers.
Thank you.
Right, Representative Holvey, my name is Art Cummins, and we've been talking about my daughter and son-in-law, this is how this first came to my attention. But subsequent to all of this, I need to just, for a background basis, I'm a private practitioner attorney in Salem. I call myself the last living private general practitioner. I represent a company called Consolidated Legal, which is a legal plan, and many people who work for the state of Oregon and other governmental agencies have this plan, and it provides them legal representation at a lesser hourly rate. And I'm kind of their lawyer in the Salem area. And this also includes Nike and Tektronix and a lot of the other big companies that whose employees buy the plan or it's furnished to them as a benefit. Through that process, I am getting more and more of these cases. At first, I knew it wasn't just limited to our family, but now I know that there are many, many others who are affected, and they're beginning to express their concern and outrage as they file or proceed to talk to a bankruptcy attorney because of this situation. This situation is very extreme, if you will, in the Eugene area. There's quite a bit of it in Salem, and what we are proposing is that we join other states in the United States, particularly Arizona and California, in remedying a problem with this bill or this law. This law was created back in the 50s, and there was never a problem with this particular section until we got into the middle and late 2000s. There was a judge in a dissenting opinion when this law came before the Court of Appeals back in the 90s. The case was Urbach versus Monchamp Corporation, and I think you have a copy in the materials we provided. I think if you read Justice Warren's dissenting opinion in that case, the majority basically said this is the interpretation that we give the legislation as it exists at this present time. But it doesn't necessarily solve the problem, but that's a problem for the legislature. And Justice Warren took that task and dissented and said we need to do something about it. But that's a dissenting opinion, and certainly dissenting is not the majority. But it explains the situation as well as I could do as to what the problem is and how it needs to be remedied. I wrote a short summary, about 2.25 pages, that you have in your materials. It's entitled House Bill 3004, Oregon Trust Deed Act, and it summarizes the fact situation that gave rise to this bill. It also discusses a federal case and quotes significant language from that case, which tells us that the federal court is critical of Oregon's law. This is in the year 2000, and points out that something needs to be done. A magistrate in our Oregon District of Federal Court tried to do something about it, but was overturned because, in essence, the federal court said it's the Oregon legislature that must deal with this problem, not the courts. We don't legislate in the courts. We just interpret and enforce. That's basically the situation. I did a little bit of we have in the legal industry, I think you all know, we have what we call listservs, where lawyers in a particular expertise by email send out inquiries to other lawyers to see if they've had similar situations or to help with interpretations and presentations. And I sent this out. I'm not a member of this listserv, but there are lawyers in Salem who are. And I asked them to put this on the listserv, and we got various responses. I think they are in your packet as well. One of them particularly is from a fellow named Charlie Harris in Newburgh. He's part of the CASA of Oregon organization, and when he saw this, he commented in his email, which talk about predatory lending practices. Is this an issue that should be addressed by the 09 legislature? I should think that this eliminating deficiency judgments on second loans, trust deeds, and mortgages, particularly where the mortgage beneficiary is the same body on both loans, would be an easy way for the legislature to address the housing crisis without spending any money. Does the RELU section have any input? That's the listserv. Does the RELU section have any input into legislation that the Oregon State Bar pursues? In other words, they're suggesting the Oregon State Bar should pick this up and run with it. Well, Jane and I just felt we'll talk with Representative Clem and see if we can get it started, because we think that there's a hole here that some clever lenders and their agencies, real estate brokers and mortgage companies and whatnot, saw an opportunity to sell property at a high purchase price and arrange payments with balloons, normally the purchaser would not qualify for these loans at all under conventional financing. So basically you say we're going to, on a $380,000 house, we can qualify them for a first for $280,000 and put it at a payment they can afford, and then the balance we'll put in a second trust deed against the property, and the $100,000, and we'll put that monthly payment low enough so that this family of two people at least that are working can afford it within their budget, or so they think. Then there's usually a balloon coming somewhere down the road. Well, and the hope would be that they could refinance this whole package into one loan, which is not realistic as a practical matter, and wasn't and wouldn't have been and under any circumstances, even in 2005, 6, or 7, when this practice was rampant around the country. So what happens then? The bottom line is, and we all in this room, I'll bet almost 2-1, have a trust deed transaction for our home. Because that's the way Oregon does it for residential property. It's all trust deeds. And all that means is that if you miss a payment and they give you notice that they're going to foreclose, they have to tell you basically this is what you have to pay to bring it current, and it includes costs and attorney's fees and the amount of money that's behind. You have to bring that all up within a certain period of time. Most people can't do it. So they say, now what do we do? Well, you get a notice in the mail that says your property 6 months down the road is going to be sold by public sale on the steps of the courthouse. And that's what happens. In Oregon, as soon as the property is sold, the owner has 10 days to get out. That's basically what happens. And the lender takes the property back. Under our laws that exist now, if there is only one loan against the property, one trust deed, which includes a promissory note, that's part of the trust deed transaction. If there's just one, we don't have a problem. The problem is, then at that point, there's no deficiency in Oregon. They take the property back, and the homeowner does not have to, or the former homeowner does not have to worry about somebody coming back against them for any deficiency. That's our law as it stands right now. The lending practices that we ran into was you get the first loan with the trust deed and the note, and then to make up the total amount of the purchase price that they want for the property, they do a second loan against the property. And in the case that I'm talking about, it was the same company from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Franklin, that did both loans. They were closed in the same day, and it wouldn't matter whether they were closed a week apart, as long as they all relate to the basic purchase price of the property. So you have two trust deeds and two notes. And one is called the junior and one is the senior. Okay, so the default occurs. And this is what happens. And this is what happened in the case that with our children. They foreclosed by notice and sale on the first trust deed and note. Took the property back. Okay? And, of course, they're stuck with any deficiency on that trust deed and note. But there's still the second trust deed and note. And they are allowed under Oregon law to sue on the note. So the suit will come for $100,000. So they don't have their home, and they still have to pay $100,000. My belief is that the fair way to deal with this, and I think our state court feels the same way, as well as the federal court, that any money that relates, whether it's a first, second, third, whatever, that relates to the basic purchase price, in the example I gave, $380,000, any number of notes could be written. If that property is taken back from the borrower, all of those deficiencies go with it. That's the fair way to deal with it. Now, if at a later time, after they get a first trust deed and buy property, they put a second on because they're doing improvements, or they're taking out a line of credit down the road for some other purpose, has nothing to do with this. That's perfectly fine. It's that initial purchase money that we're talking about. If they take the property back, they take all the debt that went with it in the very beginning, in the inception. That's what we're talking about. Now, what do other states do? I didn't have the time to research 50 states, but I will tell you this, that California, number one, does not allow deficiencies on properties that are 2.5 acres or less and used for residential purposes, period. They take the property back, they take all the debt related to it that relates to the purchase price of it. Arizona, same thing. They have a little larger parcel of property. And those two states are two of the biggest problems as far as foreclosures are concerned in this country. So I got that far. I can do more, I just didn't have time to do that. So...
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, the one thing I wanted to add in is, having talked with a number of folks who are involved in mortgage brokering, what they said to me was, not necessarily is there a nefarious purpose. We split it up 80-20 sometimes to get around private mortgage insurance or something like that, and it was real common, and everybody did it. We had no idea that someone could go after the lender for the second, or the borrower for the second. We just thought it was treated the same as other Oregon law. If it's 95% mortgage and 5 down, and it gets foreclosed on, you know, and they lose their home, that's it. If they sell it in foreclosure for less than they still owed, that's the lender's problem under current law. And the question is, if it's this, and the way the bill's structured, it's the same lending institution, all to the original purchase price, just because it got split up 80-20 or 70-30 or whatever to get around insurance. I mean, I'm not even interested in attributing nefarious practices, whatever reason it got split up. Why would the law be different, and these folks are now lost everything, and they've got a debt collector going after them on something? And that's the situation that folks are finding themselves in. Mm-hmm. Again, particularly this one out-of-state entity that I think at this point is not even making loans, if I understand it. They are just in the debt collection business.
Yeah, if the history on First Franklin is very interesting, because that's all they did, doing these types of loans for their owner, Merrill Lynch. Well, we all know what happened to Merrill Lynch, and in March of 08, if you can verify this on the internet, in March of 08, those bad loans, these toxic assets, if you will, Merrill Lynch knew they were under fire. They cut loose First Franklin and turned them into a collection agency, and basically wanted to have nothing to do with those loans, so they took those toxic assets out of their inventory, and of course, we know that in the ensuing months, things got really bad for Merrill Lynch and others, and they went down. But this isn't just little First Franklin, which is big First Franklin. They wrote most of the loans in Oregon for this type of a transaction. But I want to correct one thing that Representative Clem said. We don't want to create another loophole in this bill, and that is where a lending agency like First Franklin creates another subsidiary, like call them First Benjamin, that writes the second loan. The important thing here is that the purchase money mortgage, that total package, goes with the property if the property is taken back. So it doesn't matter who the lenders are or anything. If it's all the purchase price, if the purchase price is $380,000 and Wells Fargo takes $100,000 of it, First Franklin takes $200,000, and Pioneer Trust takes $80,000, they're all in the same boat. They are doing creative financing, and they are relying on that property as security. And if they take, any one of them, take that property back, they take the debt with it. That's the purchase money mortgage that we're talking about. So it looks like Jane's got
something. Well, I apologize. I thought that we had written into the bill same financial institution, but I was trying to characterize what was in the bill, and that's not in the bill.
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't get into all the detail, but the key to this is ORS 86770, Section 2. It's on the first page of the bill under Section 1, about the middle of the page, starting in line 12. That is the whole key. And when Warren dissented in the case in the 90s, he concluded that the majority's construction rendered the statute meaningless because he felt that though it was a pro-lender trust deed act, that legislators also wrote into it some protection for the borrower by saying that the borrower who lost the security would not also lose more money. He also said that the majority's construction produced an absurd and unreasonable result, and that a lender should not be permitted to avoid the constraints of the 86772 through the creative financing. And at the federal level, which the case is cited on the first page of Art's handout, the court pointed out, I think, you know, the summary of this. If a creditor holds both trust deeds and both notes, the creditor retains a cause of action on the second, even though it forecloses on the property, and I'm summarizing. And the statute's preservation of a cause of action for junior creditors creates a loophole for shrewd creditors. It permits the lenders to avoid the statute's constraints simply by requiring a borrower to execute two notes and two trust deeds. And then on default, the lender forecloses, recovers the security, the home, precludes the borrower from redeeming the property, and then brings an action on the other note. And that's what we're trying to prevent. And that's what's happening more and more.
So let me get this clear just real quickly. I think I understand your concept. So are you proposing that when it's involving the purchase money or the purchase price of a home, that if there's a first and a second and it's done by the same lender, that they wouldn't be able to sue on the second after foreclosing on the first? And my question is that, does it have to be with the same lender, or does it, if, as long as it's with the purchase price, could it be a different?
That's what I was trying to point out. It does not have to involve the same lender. It just happened to in this case, and it happens to a lot of people with this First Franklin outfit.
So you're saying if it involves two lenders,
sure,
that they shouldn't be able to foreclose on
right.
the note on
and,
the second?
And the first lender could create a subsidiary second lender, another company, and they're in cahoots, basically, to avoid, if it just limited to the same lender. So First Franklin could go out and contract with Wells Fargo to provide the second. You see?
Yeah, it's so you're saying it shouldn't price. Matter if it was two different
lenders.
It has
no matter. It doesn't
okay.
matter in California. It doesn't matter in Arizona.
Okay.
What matters is what is the purchase price and how was it financed?
Originally.
The original purchase price. In our case, with our child, it was $280,000, and they financed $230,000, and $50,000 was on the note.
All right.
They took the property back, and they're suing for $50,000.
Understand the concept.
And that happened to be the same company.
Yeah. Thank you. I just didn't get there reading the bill. But thank you. Questions, Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand this correctly, essentially second mortgages are exempt from this process, and you are personally liable for your second mortgages in Oregon. And the bill would not change that for second mortgages that are taken out later on a home, but only for the purchase price.
You got
so
that right.
You're
That's
nodding,
right.
and I believe I have that correct.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is you're talking, right now you're looking at somebody who used an 80-20 to buy his home
wow.
in Wilsonville about 5 years ago. And I believe this bill would essentially have eliminated my ability to get that home. Because the 20 would not have been offered to me, and I did not have the money down, and so I just wouldn't have gotten the home. Because what we're essentially doing with this bill is taking away a credit opportunity for a home buyer. So it worked out for me, And I don't know any other way to put it except that I think as long as people understand the risk that they're taking, obviously the whole point of a 20 and some of these what we call creative financing techniques assisted people in purchasing homes that they wanted to purchase. And obviously they took on additional risk to do that. I did. And I still own my home and I'm very happy with it. And I'm pleased that that credit option was available to me.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I've talked to multiple lenders. Some of them can testify. Most lenders that I spoke to had no idea that they couldn't collect on the second. I would ask the credit unions, who they still, their lawyers, not clear that this is not already the case under current law. They're not sure this bill is doing something that's not already legal. So I have personal confidence in these folks that you would still have the exact same product available. It's only people who felt it's fair to go after on the 20 that would not want to make those loans. But there's plenty of institutions who I've had personal conversations with that said, yeah, we had no idea that someone could be gone after on the second.
Thank you for that clarification.
And then I've had several, again, through this list service, without exception, every one of the real estate attorneys in Oregon who responded said it's perfectly legal to sue on that second note at this present time. One of my questions that I would have for you, Representative Wingard, is were you told that this could happen to you if you had to default?
It's a great question.
Because I believe you weren't.
You are correct. I was not told.
And and under most consumer protection laws, I mean, let's just look for a moment at your transaction when you bought your home.
Mr. Cummins?
Now I'm going to try to control the conversation just a little bit. So, you know, it's not a case where you're... You and Representative Wingard are asking questions back and forth.
I didn't mean to do that. I just wanted to point out when we're talking about consumer protection, and I do this all the time with clients when they ask, they buy a home and they show up at the title company and they are given a cache of documents.
Mm-hmm.
How many have ever even taken the opportunity to read those documents, let alone have them examined by a lawyer? The pencils are there, you know. And you sign right there, and you initial right there, and you never have any idea what's in those documents. And I'll bet that one also for all of us. I don't, but I just happen to be trained, so I kind of know what's in there. But most of us have no idea what's in there. If perhaps there was even a notice in bold print, maybe bolder than the little print, that said, if you default on this, this is what's going to happen to you. Even though that lending practice was available to you, I question whether you would have participated in that.
Thank you.
Because
I think
that's pretty scary.
You've laid out the bill very nicely. I think you've laid out the concept for it, and I appreciate Representative Klim and you for bringing this issue to us. I think we have another couple things on our agenda, and I'm going to end up closing this hearing at this point, but we'll reopen for others to comment on this subject, and we'll probably have another hearing on this particular bill as well. So
you've been extremely gracious with your time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
I really appreciate it.
And so thank you very much. And with that, colleagues, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3004. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2784. Victoria, give us a brief summary of House Bill 2784, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2784 creates the Task Force on Oversight of Financial Institutions Receiving Funds from the Troubled Asset Relief Program to evaluate need for regulation of state-regulated entities receiving funds. Sunsets Task Force on date of convening next regular biennial legislative session, effective on passage.
Thank you. And Representative Shields is up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent District 43, North and Northeast Portland. House Bill 2784 is a bipartisan bill co-sponsored by Representative Greg Smith, Senator Boquist, Senator Larry George, and others. And the purpose is to provide oversight of how funds are spent by state-chartered banks who receive funds from under the Troubled Asset Relief Program under the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008. The bill is about setting up a systematic process whereby the legislature can ask questions about the TARP program in the public forum to improve our banking environment for business and consumers. The topic is timely. Here in Oregon, we saw two banks fail this last year, Silver Falls in Representative Gilliam's district and Pinnacle Bank in Beaverton, where Representative Harker's business banked. Two other banks in Oregon have received cease and desist letters. Now, what's troubling about these failures in our banking community is not so much that banks fail. After all, banks do fail in a recession. But it's that these failures have come at times when over the last two or three years, we have been assured by the United Financial Lobby or the Oregon Bankers Association that things were all right here, that Oregon was different, that the problems were all at the federal level, and in the mortgage mess, it was that Oregon didn't have the same foreclosure problems as California, Nevada, and Florida. And of course, today we do. Oregon is number five in foreclosures and rising all the time. Now, I don't begrudge a group of businesses coming together to promote a point of view in ways that benefit their interests. And after all, who can blame them for trying to calm their depositors and investors in these trying times? But it's our job to cut through the spin, to ask questions, and provide the proper oversight and transparency our system needs so that taxpayer money is well spent and that businesses and consumers that depend on healthy banks can thrive. All I'm trying to say to you, colleagues, is that we've got to do the work because others won't do it for us. I filed this bill early in the session when TARP 2 was being developed and when it was unclear how many local banks would pursue and receive TARP dollars. The Oregon Bankers Association, which includes big federally chartered national banks like Bank of America, as well as the 35 state chartered banks, indicated their early opposition to the bill. So I've met with the representatives and representatives of two of the three banks that are currently receiving TARP dollars under the Capital Purchase Program. They provided a significant part of the information I requested, and I appreciate that. And I considered whether or not to move forward with the bill. And I talked to people who know the industry, and after that review, decided that, yes, a bill is needed, and I'd like to tell you why. The main reason is that the federal government is not doing a good job of oversight on this issue. The General Accounting Office and congressional oversight reports show a program in disarray. Treasury has no real published guidelines for determining who gets TARP dollars and who doesn't. McClatchy newspaper state, quote, "The massive programs designed to rescue the nation's financial sector are operating without adequate oversight, with vague goals and limited disclosure of their details to the taxpayers who are paying for them." The GAO report talked of inconsistent oversight. And in the wake of the GAO report, House Minority Leader John Boehner, the Republican from Ohio, said, quote, "No one has any idea where the money is going or how much is left or where it went." Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is the state's charge to regulate state-chartered banks. And what I'm trying to say to you is that we've got to do the work because the federal government is not going to do it for us, and we're going to have to find the facts on our own. And the frustration here in Oregon is mounting. On Friday, Portland developer Tom Moyer and Hoffman Construction announced that they are ceasing construction on a development that employed 350 construction workers. According to Ryan Frank of the Oregonian, Moyer's financial woes show that even though the U.S. Treasury pumps billions of dollars, and these are his words, billions of dollars into banks, that cash is not landing in the hands of the people who need it, and lenders' reluctance means construction workers may not receive a paycheck. The vice president of Hoffman Construction said, quote, "I get a little mad about it. The banks are getting the money, but they're not lending it out." Now, absolutely, we don't want to encourage or putting pressure on banks to make risky loans. And Moyer's project may well be risky. But the point here is that the public has questions, and they look to their elected representatives to answer them. And this bill is simply a systematic way to go about the process of asking those questions. So I told you about the opposition. What's the status of the bill today? Well, I met with the Oregon Bankers Association, heard their concerns, particularly about the potential stigma around TARP funding. And the compromise that I suggested would strip out the task force structure completely and language on recommendations on regulation. It seemed like overkill since there was only likely to be three banks that are likely to receive the funding. Instead, I have legislative counsel working on a draft amendment that will state the following, something along these lines, that the House Consumer Protection Committee and Senate Consumer Protection Committee shall conduct hearings on the progress achieved by financial institutions as defined in the ORS that are licensed, certified, or chartered in the state and that receive TARP fundings. These banks could simply use this as an opportunity to come before you and tell you their story. They could simply bring the reports that they're sending to Treasury anyway and discuss them with us. Now, there is precedent for this approach of using statute to require interim committees to review an issue. House Bill 2981 in House Judiciary, of which Representative Krieger is a co-sponsor and Representative Cameron is the chief co-sponsor, requires the legislative committee to study and recommend changes in occupational licensing for people with criminal convictions. This would be a very similar approach. I'm saddened that the Oregon Bankers Association has rejected what I feel to be a very reasonable compromise. So it's up to you to decide whether a systematic way to ask questions during the interim is appropriate. And at the end of the day, I think this bill is about answering three key questions. Question number one, do you think that the federal government has done a good job in providing oversight of your TARP dollars? Question number two, do you think the legislature has the right to ask questions about how our TARP dollars are spent by state chartered banks? Question number three, do you think it would benefit the public to systematically ask those questions in the light of day, with the public being able to be educated along the way, and with the public being able to testify and prevent their viewpoints too? If you believe we have the right, the duty, to ask those questions, I ask you to vote yes once we get back the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to introduce the two people that will be calling in by phone when you're ready.
Okay, questions for Representative Shields? Before we make that call, Representative, I'm just kind of curious. I don't know, you know, a tremendous amount about the TARP, except what I've followed on the news, the TARP funds and all of that. So I'm not aware of what any federal regulations on the TARP funds and, you know, I guess, you know, our ability to actually look at those regulations that the federal government to put out. I'm sure it's mostly public document. Have you looked at any of that specifically?
Well, Mr. Chair, there's the Treasury oversees the TARP program, and they've been providing some reports, and then the General Accounting Office and the Congressional Oversight Committee have been also looking at those, and I think part of the challenge is that there hasn't been a whole lot of disclosure and transparency in that, and hopefully that'll improve, and with this bill, it would give the banks that receive this money a chance to come before Oregon and tell their story.
I guess where I was trying to get at, I'm not aware what the requirements from the federal government were to the banks receiving TARP funds and what they should do with the funds.
Well, you know, that's the question of the day. The application for TARP funding was, I think, 2 pages long. Most people filled it out in about 24 hours, and the purpose of it has certainly been a moving target.
Okay, thank you. Representative Widener, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You might know this, or you might not, but wasn't a lot of that money funneled through AIG to the banks?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Widener, Representative Widener, yes, that is true, that once the banks receive bailouts, then in the kind of the credit default swap world, they ended up paying out insurance benefits to those same banks.
Follow-up.
I'll be kind of interested in hearing from the bankers, because there's a lot of money that was getting funneled around, which disgusted a lot of citizens, even to different countries, because think, wasn't France given like $19 billion out of that? $19 billion to Germany, $17 billion to France, and another $13 billion to the UK. And so the money's been flying out to a lot more than just banks. So there's a lot of information we need, and I don't know if we can, at the state, if we're going to be able to handle this ourselves. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Witter, I think your point is very well taken. I think what this bill does is focus on the state chartered banks, and part of the reason is because those big, huge issues, I think, are going to be taking up more and more of the federal government's time in trying to disentangle. And if you look at the amount of dollars that are coming to the state of Oregon directly from the TARP program, it's about $260 million compared to about $180 billion dollars that are going to the capital purchase program overall, which, if you do the math, I think is about 0.1%. And that's part of the reason why I think it's reasonable for us to simply be in a forum where we can ask questions in the light of day, because I just can't see the federal government and all of its regulatory challenges focusing too much attention on this $260 million when there's, you know, another billions and billions up there for regulation.
Representative Tomei, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. So do we know which three banks are likely to get the TARP funds?
Yes. There are three banks that are receiving them right now, Umpqua Bank, Premier West, and Capital Pacific.
Right. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So if we were to set up this group and the banks would report to this group, this would just be public information. We would have no right to refuse the money or refuse it or question them receiving it or anything. It's just transparency. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, and that's why I was a little surprised that they decided to oppose or not accept the compromise, because the way I picture it is they would just come down, not even really have to prepare anything in written testimony, and just report on some of the reports that they've been making to the Treasury.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you, one more time, tell me the compromise that was offered and rejected?
That we strip out the entire bill, basically, and just put into the bill a requirement that recipients of TARP funding come before the committee three times during the interim and one time into the Senate Consumer Protection Committee.
Okay. Question? Representative Krieger.
Why would you want it three times here and once over there?
I figured it was a good starting point for the negotiation, frankly.
Okay.
And,
all right.
And
good answer.
And Senator Bonamici, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, Senator Bonamici might have had some qualms if I tried to force too many hearings down her throat without clearing it with her. I figure I'd deal with that on the side.
Representative Shields, did you clear the three meetings with me? and don't answer that.
Well, it depends. I know the answer. Depends on how interested you are in moving the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
His emphasis was he was just a skilled committee chair that he knew you would breeze through it.
Any other questions?
Moving on.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, at this point I'd like to suggest we call Bill Black, and then I'd be happy to introduce him while you're calling him up.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Bill Black is an associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board in the 1980s and played a key role in overseeing the S&L crisis. He was deputy director of the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation. He was SVP and general counsel of the Federal Home Loan Bank of San Francisco.
Yes, Mr. Black, this is Paul Holby. I'm a state representative from Oregon, and I'm chair of the House Consumer Protection Committee, and Representative Chip Shields has introduced a bill around state charter banks receiving TARP funds and wanting them to report to this body on the use of those funds. Mm-hmm. And he has just introduced you, and essentially, we're looking for your testimony on this particular proposal.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And if you would identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is William K. Black. I'm an associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Are you there?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm getting a beeping on this end.
Well, we don't hear the beeping at this end, so you're
okay.
You're coming
I'll proceed.
Through.
Okay. Your permission.
Please continue.
All right. The oversight at the federal level, in fact, as Representative Shields has remarked, I believe, been extremely weak, and that's not outside people's head. That's the overviewers that they put in place to judge their compliance, particularly a professor from Harvard who has found really systematic problems at the federal level. So it's not a question of it's already being done at the federal level. It isn't. I think it would be beneficial from the standpoint of the state. I must say, in general, I'm a proponent of the states actively regulating their state chartered institutions. I've worked with state regulatory bodies when I was a federal regulator, and state regulatory efforts with regard to their institutions were often exceptionally important and effective. So this fits into my general view that you have a very important role to play at the state level with regard to your own institutions. It is certainly the case that disproportionately the problems in the current crisis are in the largest money center banks and investment banks and, to some extent, insurance companies. However, it is also the case that there are significant numbers of troubled institutions that are much smaller simply because they followed investment practices that were similar. So it doesn't matter what size of bank you are, if you went into a large number of mortgage instrument products, you will have suffered really severe losses. And that will be true regardless of which state in the nation you are in this time. So you need to know, as a state, what are our institutions in, right? What is their exposure to the financial derivatives? What is their exposure to the non-prime lending? Have they reviewed the files? We've discovered that in virtually all cases, institutions that acquired non-prime assets, like CDOs, did so without ever reviewing even a sample of the files. And we've discovered from Fitch, the smallest of the three rating agencies, that when they finally, after the markets had collapsed, reviewed a small sample of the files, they found that the results were disconcerting and that there was the appearance of fraud in nearly every file. We also know that institutions in general have not been recognizing their losses adequately, which is why they keep on having these negative earnings surprises, which is why the stock market valuations are trading at such a pittance, and while you know a number of institutions have been forced down towards penny stock levels in terms of their stock evaluations. We also know that criminal referrals are often not made, period. And that is a tremendous warning sign, given how very substantial the FBI has been testifying about the epidemic of mortgage fraud publicly since September 2004. But when the federal entity that looks at these criminal referrals, which is FinCEN, looks, it finds incredibly patchy compliance, so that large numbers of banks have never filed a single criminal referral on mortgage fraud. Now, of course, I don't know the situation in the particular banks, but that's the point. Nobody outside those banks knows the situation, and unfortunately, sometimes the banks don't know because they have very weak controls. So that's the type of thing that you would want to look at both the regulatory level and at the oversight level of a legislature. And I'll simply conclude on this note. Virtually everyone agrees that the antidote going forward is greater transparency and to have active regulation and to have active oversight at both the state legislative level and the federal legislative level. So I encourage you and indeed applaud you for looking assertively at these issues. In the long run, this will be much better for the banks as well as for the customers.
So thank you, Mr. Black. I have one question for you. As we consider reviewing the banks that receive TARP funds and having them report to us what they utilize those funds for, I guess my question is, what would we do with that information?
Well, I think what you would do with that information is, first, simply make it public. But second, of course, the question, and it's for you, I'm not so arrogant as to tell you how to really use the information, but in your oversight role, what you may find is that institutions are sitting and not making much in the way of credit available locally at all. That has certainly been the case for a large number of national and regional banks. And if so, then, of course, it's going to undercut the entire purpose of TARP, and it's going to be very bad for the Oregon economy. And, you know, then at that point, as I say, it becomes a matter that's more appropriately, you're the elected officials. What do you consider appropriate if you find that problem existing? I don't presume that that problem will exist, but I do say it has frequently been the problem in other jurisdictions.
Okay, thank you very much for your thoughts. Other questions from the committee? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Black, I'm wondering if you were on the Bill Moyers show recently.
Yes, ma'am.
That was very impressive. Thank you.
Thank you. No other questions for you at this time. I don't see any. I appreciate your perspective on this. I guess that I appreciate you taking the time out of your life to give us your perspective on what's going on at the federal level and what the state could or might do with transparency issues and looking at what's going on with TARP funding. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Good night.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next person who will testify, her name is Michelle Rand. She is a chartered financial analyst with 30-plus years' experience in the investment management field. In 1997, she started her own business, Cascade Investment Advisors, and she was just awarded the Portland Business Journal ORCID Award for Entrepreneur of the Year for 2009. She has a wide variety of financial experience, including 16 years in the trust department of various banks.
I don't think that's
going to
work.
I think you may have to dial a one.
I think that was her fax machine the first time.
Yes, Ms. Rand, this is Paul Holvey. I'm a state representative in Salem right now, and I'm in a public hearing. Chair of the Consumer Protection Committee and Representative Chip Shields has arranged for us to call you to provide some testimony on a bill that he is proposing that the state legislature get a report from state chartered banks that are receiving TARP funds and providing some transparency on what they're doing with those funds. And so we're providing you an opportunity to testify on that concept.
Okay.
And you need to identify yourself, too, for the record, please.
Michelle Rand.
Thank you. Go ahead and continue.
Sure. Chip brought this up to me some time ago as far as providing transparency and maybe some oversight from the state level for banks that were doing business in Oregon that had taken TARP funds. And while I'm not particularly a fan of more regulation, and I feel that the banks are somewhat under the gun right now, trying to manage their own businesses, I am frustrated with the lack of transparency around not just what the banks are doing with the TARP money, but generally how the banks operate in terms of making loans and taking in money. I mean, I've been in business for almost 30 years, and it's very difficult to untangle SEC statements and figure out what's going on in bank accounting. So those are my primary comments. Did you have any questions that you wanted to ask me as far as what I think about this?
Well, I suppose I'm going to ask you a question I've asked previously is, from my perspective, if we were to pass a bill that required banks to report on the TARP funds that they received, what action or what do you think we as a legislature would do with that information?
Well, that wasn't necessarily, what I was thinking about for this bill. One of the things that I asked about in the first place was, what is the purpose of gaining transparency from the legislature's perspective? Is it a social policy where, you would then communicate that to constituents and they would have a better feeling about how the banks are being managed? Is it a policy of pressuring the banks towards making more loans, which is, very much in the news these days and a clear frustration on the part of business? I mean, from my perspective, I'm an advocate of better transparency for all corporations. This is, banks are particularly egregious, but I find similar frustrations with other types of both financial companies and other publicly held companies. And from my perspective, it's a frustration just on behalf of the shareholder. We are owners of the business, and my constituency is the shareholder, and I feel that I ought to know more about what's going on.
Okay, well, that's what I asked you was for your perspective on what we would do with that information. I think you sort of explained it, one for transparency so that we know what's going on, and the second would be to provide pressure to cause some sort of action for the utilization of those TARP funds, I assume. So I'm going to open up a couple other questions if anybody has any for you.
Sure.
Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Rand? Not seeing any. Representative Shields?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just in closing, I just wanted to comment that when the Oregonian was doing a story on these bills, Jeff Manning of the Oregonian called and said, so, have you seen any indication that there's been malfeasance in these three banks? And I said, no, and I'd like to keep it that way. And I think that's what this is all about, not singling out these banks as if they're doing anything wrong, but to make sure that there's proper transparency and oversight so that we ensure that doesn't happen in the future.
Thank you. And thank you, Ms. Rand, for making yourself available to testify to our committee on this issue.
You're very welcome.
I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Any other questions for Representative Shields?
I'll ask one, Mr. Chair.
Cool. Go ahead, Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an area that I know virtually nothing about, and I guess it frightens me a little bit to think of this committee as an oversight body on something that I have such little knowledge base on. So I'd be interested in exploring your thought processes as, if that were to be the case, how that would happen, what expertise is available.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, you also have, of course, a great resource in the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I would anticipate that they would also be involved in those hearings and to provide expertise and also have them in a systematic way be able to answer questions about state chartered bank regulation. I think also the nice thing about having this in a public forum is you allow other expertise from the public to come and testify and have their say, and I think that's an important piece as well. But I think really it's a pretty simple endeavor where I would think just as part of your regular agenda three times over the course of the interim, they would just come back and say, hey, these are the good things that we've done with this money.
Other questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm all for the transparency, and we talked briefly about the motivation for this. We want to get credit going, and to the extent that the legislature can help do that is a good idea. Would you be interested in another model that would maybe, if we're not, and as I understood your testimony, we're not asking for a new report. We're asking to know what reports are there or what's in those reports. Would it be possible to go to DCBS first? They summarize or report to the committee or the committee chair, and then the committee chair in the interim, this committee is probably as appropriate as others. What other words would there be? Business labor? We don't really have a banking committee, do we? Anyway, then at their discretion, and we may not need legislation for this, but nonetheless make a commitment that the chair would decide this, the report rises to the level of a briefing, a public hearing. Is that a avenue that you'd consider, or do you think we've got to have the three and the one or whatever it is?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I'm completely open to discussions. I even suggested to the Bankers Association that I'd be willing to have one of those hearings at your colleague, Representative Schaffler's committee, to see if there might be some type of compromise. So I'm still open to negotiating this. If they'd like to come back to the table, I'd be more than happy to entertain some things.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I think we can work through that. I hope we can. In a way, you're also kicking us in the tail a little bit and saying, what is our responsibility to find out what is out there? Because in many ways, this information is available. There is a reporting requirement. There is information. There is state regulation. And what are we doing as a body to monitor that or to bring that to light? So I think it can be a two-way street in many ways.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I couldn't agree more.
Any other? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just wanted to say a couple of things about, I believe that it's quite appropriate for us to perform an oversight function, and I think that this is as good a committee as any to do it, and the only thing is the methodology, how we get there. And I think that we need to work that out and make sure that we have a good way to do it, and that we get it done. I don't know if it takes a bill or if we can reach some agreement, but I agree that we have oversight authority and responsibility.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're bringing a few statements in, I actually like the idea of your bill, even if it doesn't go anywhere, because It'll teach the private sector for taking tax dollars, and it's something that's kind of upset me a little bit in this whole process, so it's kind of trampled on capitalism a little bit. But I think with the TARP money needing to go to loans for what it's designed for, we need to make sure it's getting back into the private sector's hands, even if in one way or another, but I don't know if it's something we should be doing at the state. But I don't have a lot of faith in Barney Frank either, unless you do, Mr. Shields.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wender, I'll take a pass on that question. But but one thing that I wouldn't mention, and I think what you would agree with, is that when government money does subsidize a business, you end up being in the business of picking winners and losers. And one of the things that was frustrating about this, the TARP funding process, is that there was really no criteria on who's going to get the money and who's not. I read an article that essentially there are four people at Treasury who make the decisions, and nobody really knows why. There's no documentation of it. Now, I've run an organization that has applied for government grants before, and I can tell you that we've never had a grant application for government funding that was two pages, and that where the objectives were not very well laid out in the Federal Register.
Thank you. I think I've I need to move on,
yeah.
And I think you've presented your bill adequately and the testimony as well. So I'd like to move on and get the testimony from the Bankers Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I get back to Judiciary Committee. Is this still going on?
It could be.
All right. Thanks.
It wasn't where I left.
Thank you. Up next, I have Linda Navarro, Mark Stevenson, and Tim Martinez. Good evening, and welcome to the House Committee on Consumer Protection, and you're lucky to catch us in an evening time slot.
Well, and we thank you for that, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Office brief, Linda Navarro and Mr. Stevenson are going to provide the bulk of the testimony. But as I was reading Representative Shields' remarks, I did want to make a couple of my own since I have been the one that has been talking to him. We have agreed, and I think others on this committee have said it very well, that you do have oversight ability. You certainly can. Many of you have held gavels, do hold gavels now. But for the freshmen, I would tell you that it is not uncommon for a committee chair, as they put together their interim work plan, to look at specific issues. And what we have told the sponsor of the bill that we have no problem with that. We're all for transparency, as I think Linda and others will tell you, is, the federal government is still feeling their way through this. And one thing that they just announced last month is that this information will be released not only in the aggregate, but also on individual bank-by-bank basis. So that is, I think, Representative Gilling was talking about that. That information is already there. And we're happy to provide that to any committee that wants it or any member that individually wants that. But when the sponsor talks about rejecting it, we've agreed, fine, if you think and Chair Holvey or whoever has the gavel in the interim believes that there ought to be two hearings on that, we'll be here and testifying on that and providing the information that you've requested. What we struggle with is the need for a bill to do that. And listening to the amendments that Representative Shields talked about, it's hard for me to see the Senate, your colleagues on the other side of the building, say, okay, this is a bill for House Consumer Protection, but go ahead and tell us we're going to have a hearing, too, in the interim. I mean, that I haven't been around here forever, but I've been around here about 20 years. I've never seen that type of legislation. Now, it is true that the Judiciary Committee in the interim is a joint committee, and that occasionally they do things together. Again, not necessarily because of a law that's passed, but they do work together as they set up the schedule. At least as far as I know, today, the Consumer Protection Committee will probably not be a joint committee. So we support the information getting to you. I would just tell you that this is a work in progress. The last comment I would make before I turn it over to Linda is Representative Shields also talked about where the United Financial Lobby has been the last couple of years. The last couple of years, this body has been focused primarily on subprime lending. We are not in the situation in Oregon where we've had the two bank failures, which is sad. We're not in that situation in Oregon because of subprime lending in Oregon. We're in that situation because of what's happened at the national level. The community banks in Oregon are by and large in sound financial shape and did not make the subprime loans that we were addressing 2 years ago. So with that, I'll be quiet, be happy to take any questions, and I know Linda has some prepared testimony.
Representative Riley.
Thank you. I agree with a lot of what you said, Tim, but we could at any time in the interim, of course, have a joint committee by agreement of the chairs. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, of course, absolutely.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Linda Navarro, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association, and we represent the 60 banks that do business in this state. And when I refer to banks, I mean real banks, traditional banks that are highly regulated. Usually I say not AIG, but maybe today it's more appropriate to say not Merrill Lynch after your earlier testimony. I'm joined today, and you'll hear in just a moment, from Mark Stevenson, who's CEO of Capital Pacific Bank, one of the three banks that would be affected by this legislation. I'm actually pleased to be here, and before I begin just talking a little bit about this bill in particular, I'll piggyback on something Tim said. It's not just that we would be willing to come and talk about the TARP program or CPP or how the funds are being spent. I think it's absolutely important for the legislature and for Oregonians to understand much more than what's happening at these three banks. We have an industry that's an important part of our economic engine in this state, and I welcome speaking to this body, to this committee, as well as we regularly speak all the time to chambers and rotary groups and all kinds of community groups about these very same issues, because it is important that there is a clear understanding not only about this program but about the industry as a whole and the issues that have been raised by others who have testified tonight, such as lending, accounting, transparency. So I would offer that we would be more than happy at any time to communicate with any of you individually or as a group on the industry as a whole and the issues that we're contending with in this very challenging environment. With that said, one of the major points I wanted to make is that the TARP program is very complex at the federal level, but what this bill hones in on is the three state-chartered banks, as you've heard, Umpqua Bank, Premier West Bank, and Capital Pacific Bank in this state, who received funds under this capital purchase program, which is a program of the TARP program. There's no other state charter bank in this state that's received TARP funds. And I know there's certainly been mention tonight of failed banks. If there was such a thing as a bailout for a state chartered Oregon bank, those two banks probably wouldn't have failed. This is not a bailout. And that's a point I want to make, because there have been bailouts of major financial companies, non-bank companies in particular, at the federal level. But what we're talking about with this bill is three banks that got capital in the form of a preferred stock investment in their bank by the government, which receives dividend payments on that investment. And eventually, the bank pays the taxpayer back. It's not a bailout. It's not a handout. It's a source of capital that was designed, and really, if it weren't for the fact that it gets so much negative attention, it's actually a pretty creative approach to spending the stabilization funds, as opposed to putting them down a black hole, because it puts capital into community banks and larger national and regional banks for the purpose of stabilizing the economy and lending those funds back out in the community. I emphasize this, and I gave you just a one-page document right off the Treasury's website that explains this program, because this is a voluntary program that there is criteria for. I'm not sure where that misunderstanding comes from, but there's criteria. Banks had to apply for this program, and several banks in Oregon were accepted. Three opted so far to take the funds. The reason several others haven't taken the funds, even though it's a decent source of capital, is because the negative information and the misunderstanding about this program makes it very challenging from a public relations standpoint. And yet, from the standpoint of the taxpayer and from the standpoint of Oregonians, we benefit from the $260 million and potentially more that has flowed into our state in the form of capital, which is leveraged 7 to 10 times in the form of lending. And to discourage that in any way among state-chartered healthy banks does a disservice to Oregonians. And it actually makes the funds are going to be available to banks throughout the country. I think it's a mistake to discourage those funds here in Oregon. So just real quickly, and then I'll turn it over to Mark. Specifically, we're in opposition to House Bill 2784 because, as I said, it singles out three healthy banks. It doesn't address the broader question of transparency and information, which we're happy to work with you on within the industry. It discourages these banks from keeping this capital. In fact, because of the misinformation and misunderstanding about these programs, some banks around the country have chosen to give their capital back. And we've had banks here in Oregon suggest that they may, if it makes sense or if legislation passes that penalizes them, so to speak, that they would consider giving that capital back. I'm not sure how that's in the best interest of Oregon. But it does discourage additional banks from taking this capital. I also want to note that around regulation and transparency and reporting, Mark's going to talk a little bit about the specific reporting. There's significant reporting, monthly reporting, not just quarterly reporting, and it is going to be made public, as Tim mentioned. Financialstability.org is a website that I would encourage you to go to. All of these transactions are published there. All the information about these programs are published, and that's eventually where they're going to publish the reports that they're generating and producing about how banks are using these funds. Two final quick points. The Department of Consumer and Business Services is the primary regulator, in addition to the FDIC and federal regulators of these three banks. Mm-hmm. The state does have oversight authority over these banks. DCBS does a good job regulating these banks, and they know exactly how this capital is being deployed. They look at capital every time they go in and examine these banks, and banks report quarterly in the form of call reports, all banks, in terms of their lending activity. So DCBS very much, and the state of Oregon, very much oversees these three banks, as they do all state chartered banks. And finally, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, we've mentioned this before on other issues, but banks, the way they're organized, and I'm not sure how much all of you know about this, but they have a choice of what kind of charter they adopt when they organize. They can adopt a state charter or a federal charter, in which case their primary regulator is the OCC, not the state of Oregon. Right. It doesn't matter if they're headquartered in Oregon or not. It has to do where they choose their charter. And in the past, because Oregon's been a very strong state with parity between state and federal chartered banks, encouraging banks to organize here and be supervised locally by the state, we've actually enjoyed the state charter being the charter of choice. And it still is today, although our recently our last few banks that have organized in Oregon. One's in organization right now. It just got an OCC federal charter. But I point this out because Umpqua Bank, even though it operates in three states, it's headquartered in Oregon, and it still enjoys an Oregon state charter and pays over $500,000 to DCBS in fees for the examination of that bank. And I think it's important that we don't that we look at banking holistically in this state and the supervision and making sure our state has the appropriate level of supervision of banks. But to single certain banks out or to make disparity in regulation or reporting requirements between state charter banks in Oregon and other banks actually could encourage the federal charter to be the charter of choice. And I think as a state, we've benefited from having banks headquartered in this state willing and generally choosing the state charter. So I'll stop there, and thank you, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate your comments, and quite frankly, this committee hasn't asked you to come forward and give us any report on this at this, so I appreciate your offer to all of that, and I appreciate comments you've made as well. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a question from a colleague about we have the responsibility for this. What authority do we have? And my answer to him was, with state charter banks, we have total authority for that oversight. Am I correct in that? Do you agree with what I just said?
For the Department of Consumer and Business Services, absolutely, although banks are subject to 6,000 pages of federal regulation, so there are some confines there. But
right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you said... Follow up, please.
Follow up.
You said through the department, but we actually are right here have
absolutely
that authority. Is that not correct? So we could ask you to come in and give us these reports next week if that's what we wanted to do.
Chair Hovey, Representative Riley, so long as we weren't asking to divulge information that's confidential, certain information that banks have is not publicly available until their quarterly call reports are filed, and some is not ever made publicly available, such as their examination ratings by the Division of Finance.
Committee, I'd really like to move on with the rest of the testimony, and I have one more bill on the agenda that I was hoping to get to, so I'd like to give Mr. Stevenson an opportunity to speak to us. Thank you. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. I'll try to be quick, but my name is Mark Stevenson. I'm the CEO of Capital Pacific Bank. We're a six-year-old, $135 million community bank based in Portland. Our primary business is working with local businesses that specialize in nonprofit organizations, property management firms, and professional firms. About a third of our deposits are from nonprofit organizations. I'm glad to say that we're profitable, have been profitable, and we're very well capitalized, and we were well capitalized even before we applied for the TARP. I do have some concerns about the House bill, and I'll speak to those, but I guess first of all, I know I just heard here today on the committee some concerns that are really of a broader nature that relate to what we all read about in the newspaper every day nationally about the Merrills and the AIGs of the world. I think those have affected all of us in a way that makes us react negatively to what we see, and it's frankly infuriating. I know that that concern exists with everyone, not just here at the state, but even with banks like mine. I mean, it's something that we talk about. The bonuses that we saw paid out at Merrill Lynch and EIG are really, really quite distressing. I guess a concern I have is that, as Linda was mentioning, that there's obviously been a bailout aspects for the big banks. I mean, Citibank, B of A, the banks that were required to take TARP in the initial round, I think, first of all, gave TARP a black eye. But when I go back to when we first applied for TARP last fall, at that time, when the program was announced, it was specifically made available and announced and publicized as a mechanism for healthy banks to attract capital to lend into their communities, and that's exactly why we applied for it. and I can give a little bit of background on that as well. Last spring, a year ago, we raised money through a private equity offering and boosted our capital to 13%. And at that time, that was about 30% higher than what you need to be to well, be well capitalized by regulatory standards. So you need to be 10%. We are at 13%. Last fall, we had a strategic planning session, which we do annually, to see where we were. And I conducted a survey among our various board and management member team. And a lot of questions that we asked, but one of them was, what do we think about the upcoming economy? And without fail, as you might imagine, the results were that everyone said it was going to be dismal. And as a result of that question, then I said, given your view on the economy, what level of capital do we think that we should maintain going into a tough economy? And the answer to that was basically 13%. We liked where we were. But we also are a growing bank. We're a young bank, as I mentioned, 6 years old. We feel that there's opportunity in these tough times to be able to capitalize. We all remember back to the 1990s when Wells Fargo bought First Interstate Bank, and there was, Wells Fargo was throwing everyone out the door. And, Portland's a small market. Everyone has a long-term memory, and we can remember those things. And so, we're bound to, and desiring to take advantage of these opportunities to see where maybe other people are throwing babies out with the bathwater. So at any rate, the additional capital in the form of TARP was something that would allow us to continue to grow our bank. We do have about four different primary reasons why we have some concerns about this bill, and I'd just like to enumerate them. As Linda mentioned, we already are subject to significant regulatory oversight, regulated by the state of Oregon, by the FDIC, and the Federal Reserve Bank. And now, as a result of the TARP, we are also regulated by SIGTARP, which is the Special Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Relief Program. And this is a special entity created by Congress to audit TARP banks. As a result of that, we had an initial questionnaire that we answered a series of questions about why we elected to participate in the capital purchase program and provided statistics on our loan activity. In addition, the Treasury is requiring monthly loan reports, as Linda pointed out, and these loan reports are quite detailed. I did want to point out something because I hear about this, taking taxpayer money and spending it. I can understand that in the context of a bailout, but the banks that are here in Oregon that we received TARP, we received ours at the very end of December, are not bailout situations, and this is actually an investment. We've already paid our first dividend on this. The TARP is structured as for us as a private bank. We have a publicly traded stock, but we're under the private bank exemption since we don't have SEC reporting, pay a 5% cash dividend to the state on a quarterly basis, and there was an extra 5% kicker on this, which is, in other words, we issued $4 million of TARP, and there's another $200,000 in which we pay 9% cash dividend to the U.S. Treasury. And so the taxpayers are receiving a return on their investment. The key is whether or not they're coming from healthy banks. And again, I'd like to point out that we're well capitalized, we've been profitable, we expect to continue to be profitable. It's a tough economy. We've got our battle armor on to the 13% capital ratio I talked about, but we have the capital to be able to support our growth. That's why we took it then. That's what we have now. The issue that we have is that there's been a big shift in thought process about the TARP, and that now it's become a real negative connotation. When we first got this approval, we, like Umpqua, went out and announced, hey, we got TARP. We're a good bank. Because, as Linda mentioned, there was a criteria, and the criteria consisted of where do you stand in your CAMEL ratings, and you had to be in the upper half. In other words, there's a rating system of 1 through 5, and you need to be in the better half of these things to be able to be qualified. They also took a look at our construction portfolio, and I mentioned that we're a business bank. I don't think many banks did here in Oregon have any subprime loan activity. We also have a very small percentage of our portfolio that's dedicated to residential development loans. It was less than 5% of our loans. So that 5% was very painful, by the way, but we got it well identified and under control. And the state regulators have been very complimentary in their last exam from last August about the level of diversification in our loan portfolio. We're a conservative bank with a conservative management team. Our chief credit officer spent over 10 years with the FDIC, and he closed down a lot of banks in the 1980s. He knows what that's like. He doesn't want to go through that at our bank. I just want to really point out that, speaking for ourselves, but I think it's probably true for the other two banks as well, that we're healthy banks. We're not a bailout situation. And I think that's really important because I think there is a lot of perception. Now, I've walked through the halls and people find out. I was at a nonprofit organization last week and telling them about, we were talking about their organization and the type of work they do in doing internships. And then we talked about a little bit about my bank, and I showed them our capital ratio, and she said, "Oh, good, you're not one of those TARP banks." And I said, "Oh, you're killing me." Okay, because, you know, I said, so then I have to have a conversation. I have a conversation about it all the time with people. So our clients, our prospects, everyone wants to know, because the first word out of your mouth is like, "Oh, I didn't know you were troubled. I heard Len Bernstein was in our building in the Fox Tower. When he heard that Umpqua got TARP, he said, I didn't know they were in trouble." So I understand that the connotation is out there, but what's actually now resulted is, because of all the negative connotation, there are banks, six banks that have chosen to give TARP back, and the banks, there may be some banks out there that wanted to give it back because they didn't want to get their bonuses paid. I don't know. I can't speak for that. I can certainly speak for my own bank. When I heard about the limits on executive compensation, I asked my chairman to say, "Can I have that?" Because, you know, it's really the issues that relate to the rules behind TARP are not a problem for us. We don't pay cash dividends. We don't do stock repurchases, and we don't pay excessive dividends. We're not AIG. And so, really, it's really more the connotation. And these banks that have given it back, and I know one of the CEOs at one of the banks that did give it back personally, I used to work with him many years ago, and he said it's really the negative stigma associated with it. Signature Bank, also out of New York, gave it back because they said it's affecting their business model. Now, the last thing that I want to do is to do something that would say to give back money that was to support our business plan, which is to support growth. But I'll tell you, my CFO is feeling like, you know, she's all about the numbers and about the perception, and she says, you know, we don't need the capital. We could just, like, hunker down and just stay where we are. And she's tempted to want to give it back. So I'm not saying that we're suggesting to give it back, because that's not where my head is. I'm very clearly dedicated to our strategic plan, which is to support our community in making loans.
Well, thank you for your testimony, and being one that wasn't asked about whether we should create TARP funds at the federal level or not. Notwithstanding that, those TARP funds exist, and I'm glad you applied for them, and I hope you don't give them back, because I'd like to see them stay here in Oregon and do some good. So I appreciate that, and I hope you convey that to your CFO, that I think she ought to keep them and invest them here in Oregon. So I'm going to probably move on, unless somebody has anything they really want to say at this point, because there are some people here, quite a few more people than I thought, to testify on the next bill. So I appreciate you taking the time out of your day and coming down here and giving us your opinion on this particular piece, and also your offer to talk to us at some point, if we so choose, to talk about this subject some more. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, committee, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2784. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3359. Victoria, can you give us a quick review of what this bill is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3359 imposes duties and restrictions on distressed home consultants and requires services to be provided subject to a written contract, authorizes enforcement as an unlawful trade practice punishable by maximum of 1 year's imprisonment, $10,000 fine, or both, effective on passage.
Thank you. And up first, I have Keith Carnes.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Keith Carnes. I come today as just a concerned citizen and an attorney who frequently represents folks who are in foreclosure and have other financial distress in their lives. I ask you to support House Bill 3359. I was part of the governor's work group that came up with House Bill 3630 during the interim, which put very strict, I shouldn't say very strict, but some guidelines on those who enter into the foreclosure rescue process. A lot of them turned out to be scams where individuals would go out and solicit those who were in foreclosure, offer to buy their house and lease it back to them with the option of selling it in the future. And we saw a lot of scamming going on with that in my office, and the Department of Justice said they saw it frequently as well. And so House Bill 3630 during the interim put requirements that certain contracts have to be in writing in the language that they were negotiated, and the like, for those who are buying a house in order to lease it back. during the interim session, some folks came forward and said they had a concern about the bill, saying that they do things like buy houses and then turn around and sell them to other people, and they do other things for distressed home buyers. We didn't feel that we had enough time to modify the bill to encompass everything. And so I think 3359 is a very good start for catching those things that we didn't have time to capture with 3630. The important issues that I see are that, in general, the Oregon has, and Oregon and federal law both have very strict requirements about transferring away assets while you're insolvent. We see people who are in foreclosure, and they desperately don't want a foreclosure on their credit report, and they don't want to have the stigma and the difficulty of having been foreclosed upon, and that's understandable. But what we're seeing is we're seeing people coming in and swooping in and saying, I'll buy your house from you at a discount, and then hopefully to turn around and sell it as an investment. And while that can be at times a win-win situation, when you convey away your largest single asset and then you file bankruptcy, you can actually be denied a discharge for hindering and delaying your creditors. And although you may not have had a reasonable expectation of being able to sell the house for what was later achieved for the sale, I actually am representing clients now who have had that exact problem, where they sold it to somebody who was going to turn around and sell it and share the profits. My clients are now facing the risk of not being able to discharge any of their debts in bankruptcy because they entered into one of these transactions. And they're reporting to me that they had no idea this was even a possibility, that they have all these, you know, there's state fraudulent conveyance laws as well, that if you convey away your largest assets without valuable consideration, there can be dire consequences in civil proceedings, and your creditors can actually make claims of fraud and the like. And so what we're seeing is that there are some folks who are out there trying to buy houses on the cheap and turn around and sell them at a considerable profit. I don't think anyone's really stopping to think about what are the consequences of that. And there are some that this bill would help take care of. We see also that there are many people who would otherwise fit into the foreclosure consultant and home equity purchaser that was covered under 3630 that would also be covered by this. And I'm happy to see that this bill does nothing to curtail 3630. It's my understanding, reading from this in Section 2, that there are no limitations to existing obligations. Section 2, the first sentence, appears to say that. And so I think we're not curtailing any law or stopping anything that was passed in the interim. Rather, we're providing new obligations for those that couldn't be caught in time. And I think the most important thing that's happening here is it's creating a fiduciary duty, a duty of special care to look out for the person that you're helping. And that's what lawyers like myself have, and that's what, you know, should probably happen when people are in this situation. They're desperate and they're broke and they're facing foreclosure, and requiring a fiduciary duty to make sure that there's no side deals going on and make sure there's no dishonesty or deceit or fraud was a great way to start making sure that these people who are in foreclosure and in distressed circumstances are able to have as good a deal as they can get.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thanks. Keith, I'm sorry. I'm just having trouble. Maybe it's the time of the day. I'm just having trouble following you, and I'm not an attorney, and so help me understand. So if I buy a house and I paid and it loses value over time, and I've lost my job, and I can't continue making fine payments. So say I paid $100,000 for the house, and now somebody has offered to buy it for $80,000, and I'm willing to do that rather than go into foreclosure. And so I sell it to them for $80,000. And show me where the problem is there.
Well, the problem isn't so much that you're selling your house for $80,000 if, in fact, it's worth $80,000. This bill, I think, it looks out for those people in your situation. Let's say your home's worth $80,000 and you're in foreclosure, and you see a sign up on the drive home or in the newspaper saying, you know, I buy homes, mm-hmm. or I buy mm-hmm. distressed properties. They buy it for $60,000 with a side deal to convey it to somebody else for $80,000. You're getting a $20,000 discount on that. They would be
not
getting a $20,000 discount on that. Yes, I apologize. That can actually create problems if you end up in the near future in bankruptcy, or if your creditors find out about that, they can bring a fraudulent conveyance action saying that you're defrauding your creditors by transferring away your largest assets without adequate consideration. And so it's not that we don't want this to happen. It's not that we don't want people who have no other option to not be able to sell their home if, in fact, that's the last option. I mean, I don't think we should outlaw this by any means. But just to require a contract saying you have the right to cancel this, you have the, you know, put it in the language that it's negotiated in and the like, so that those who are out there, I'm an attorney and I get called a vulture, so I'll call the, you know, this, I see it sometimes where there's just people circling around mm-hmm. distressed properties. I think we need to make sure that these are all done in writing, that the borrower knows what they're doing. They're actually conveying away the home, that they no longer will have the title to the home. If, for instance, you were 3 months behind and a foreclosure hadn't commenced, you'd have the right to live in that house for at least 120 days during the foreclosure process, rent-free, and save up your money so that you could put down a security deposit in a new place. A lot of times, you know, these people are given misinformation about what happens on a foreclosure, you know, that a foreclosure can happen right away, that, you know, there's a lot of misinformation mm-hmm. that's given, and to the extent that there's any misinformation that's passed along to this distressed home buyer, it should be accurate and it should be in the home buyer's best interest, not so that the person who's trying to make a profit on the house can just get them out of there as quick as he can.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So, Mr. Carnes, I know there's a part in this bill that speaks to the notices required by Oregon law. So the issue that I it's not issue, I guess question for you, I suppose, is people that operate in this arena, I guess, that buy homes that from people that are about to face foreclosure or this distressed home sale, they're not licensed or they're not regulated by I don't think, anyway, any of our real estate regulations or anything like that. So I'm kind of wondering how, you know, how we could impose, you know, these sorts of forms and conditions on somebody who we don't have regulatory authority over, I suppose. Do you follow what I'm saying? I'm just trying to figure out how that's put together.
Well, I think the answer is that if they are doing it under a license provided by the state, and I'm sorry, I haven't looked for that specific one, if it's a realtor, then if a distressed home consultant includes a realtor, I think we should take that out, because they are licensed by the state, and that we don't want people who are legitimately doing short sales or helping properties go back to the bank because it is their only hope. We don't want to inhibit that. The 3630, I think, did the same thing. It's not for licensed people. They're not licensed. For the most part, they're just out there operating as kind of a business model, just to go out and try and buy up these distressed homes and either convey them or rent them back or do all sorts of different things with them. And while it's a business model that can work, a lot of times this transaction just is under extreme duress, and maybe the information isn't being conveyed. Frequently, the information being conveyed isn't complete and accurate. And so requiring a contract is no different than, you know, for instance, a carpenter would have, where, you know, if we were to require carpenters to, you know, be licensed and bonded and, you know, provide estimates in writing like we do for car companies. I don't see any distinction between that and this, and I don't know if I'm answering your question or not, but I don't know that there's any requirement that the state have to license somebody in order to require them to enter into a written contract.
That did answer my question. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Matthews.
Just a brief comment, Mr. Chair, and I guess, and I appreciate that, but I guess when I kind of look at this, it's, you know, where do you stop? I mean, I understand that, I sympathize, but how do we protect people from themselves in some cases? I mean, you know, they enter into the deal, they buy the house, if they can't afford it, because, and I understand tough economic times, but if they choose to sell that for less than it's worth, and there's somebody out there fortunate enough in a position where they can buy that, that is business. And it's unfortunate because profit's not a dirty word in business. Now, I get what you're saying, but you same argument made for cars, for antique dealers, for just a whole lot of folks that might be seen as being taken advantage of, but I quite honestly think that they're grown adults entering into an agreement that they think worked best for them. I don't know how we educate them, and I don't know that this does that. And so, I'm considering it, but I'm just kind of lost on whether or not this really addresses the real problem, which is, you know, is it predatory for somebody that comes along and says, you know, you owe 120, but your house is really worth 90 to me. I've got 90 right now. I'll buy it, and somebody sells it for that. I don't get it. That's well, just
Representative Holden, Representative Matthews. I agree, and this is not a prohibition. I agree that for some people, it's going to be better to sell your house at a discount than it would be to have a foreclosure for varied reasons. And I don't think that this bill in any way prohibits that. It just requires there to be a written contract so everybody knows the terms. I mean, the statute of frauds requires that it all be done in writing anyway. This just requires a written agreement, and it just gives them a little time to think about it and back out. Under federal law, if you enter into a mortgage agreement that's not a purchase money security interest, you have a 3-day right to cancel that loan unconditionally. You can just back out and have buyer's remorse because there's a strong policy against protecting people's homes. And I think this just does the same thing. It gives them a right to back out and say, never mind, I don't want to sell you my house anymore if, you know, it's distressed. And so I agree. If these people want to operate and make money on it, and they can keep these foreclosures from happening, then let's have it done. But maybe we could just give a little protection to the homeowner, and this by no means bans anything that they're doing now, I don't believe.
Thank you. I really have to move on. I've got several people signed up, and I think our time limit is 7:30. So I appreciate your testimony, and colleagues will have another opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Carnes.
Thank you.
I know I've got several people signed up. Courtney Goodman, Anita Borges, if you call, come up if you want to speak. Mary Austin, and if I know testimony's gone on, but if you can keep your comments, and if any other people that have signed up, you know, don't repeat what somebody else has said, or if you feel like you don't need to testify because it's already been said, that'd be great too. You can also turn in your written testimony, but I'm going to have to try to keep you to a 2-minute statement.
We'll make it quick.
Thank you. And state your name for the record first, too, please. Thank you.
My name is Courtney Goodman. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for letting us be here tonight. And I'll try to make this really quick. I am a real estate investor up in Portland, Oregon, a proud member of Northwest Real Estate Investors Association, which a lot of us are here today, just to make our voice heard and tell you a little bit about what we do and how we do it. I wanted to come down here and share a little bit about what I'm going to talk about briefly is as investors, what we are and what we aren't. We have never been distressed home consultants, and there's a lot of exclusions on the proposed bills, on the proposed bill here, and we feel that we would like the purchasers, investors, buyers of properties, the principal in the transaction, to be excluded from being labeled a consultant or distressed home consultant as it is defined in this bill. We've never charged fees and never would charge fees to anyone in distress. We do not provide a service, And again, no fees are ever charged. So we're not entering into an agreement to do a forbearance agreement or a loan modification, which is all the rage right now with mortgage brokers that are out of work and, you know, going after the money. We do not do that. We don't do credit repair. We're simply buying a property from a homeowner that is in distress, and that is true. Sometimes they are facing auction. Sometimes a notice of default has just been filed. Sometimes they're just behind. But in various stages, that's where they're at. And almost 100% of the time, like Representative Matthews was saying, they are upside down, and we have to do a short sale. They might owe 100, and we buy for 60, and then we repair the property and put it back on the market and increase the neighborhood values, and, you know, we do a good turn for the neighborhood and the community. The unintended consequences of our neighbor up north in Washington, House Bill 2791 up there a couple years back in 08 or 07, had some unintended consequences of walling off both brokers and buyers and lumping them in as consultants. And foreclosure rates spiked even more up there. Days on market up there is way more than Salem and Portland. And I'm just speaking from the communities here. We do some business in Yamhill as well. But inventory and days on market is sky high, and I don't think they've recovered. And they've done some amendments to that bill to correct things, but I think the damage has been done. We're basically down here for insurance for our businesses. We are good people, ethical people. Our group up there, Northwest Real Estate Investors, has 400 members. It's a nonprofit. Education and ethics is paramount to our membership. I'm in charge of bringing in national and local speakers to educate the membership and our attendees, ranging from mortgage brokers, realtors, and investors, on how to do transactions ethically that benefit both sides. Now, most of this bill is great, just like 3630, which we've never ever, and everyone here has never entered into an equity conveyance where we keep people in the property after a foreclosure, give them a profit sharing thing down the line. That's not our aim, and never has been, and we would never enter into that type of transaction. But respectfully, I would just request again, just to exempt buyers and investors like ourselves from the definition of distressed home consultant in House Bill 3359. In summation.
Thank you. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I'm Anita Borges, and I've been a real estate investor for the past 9 years in the Portland metro area, Yamhill County, and Salem area. And primarily, the houses that I buy are all through a short sale, almost 99% of them. People are upside down and have absolutely no way to be able to sell. And usually, many times, they're expired listings, and also the houses, you know, realtors have actually turned them away, and they do not have any other options. Like Courtney was talking about, I don't enter into any situations where we're actually, you know, renting the property or leasing the property back to the people or anything of that nature. But in the process of doing the short sales, there's a lot of really good work that are done that has been done by myself and also other investors I know in terms of being able to, for instance, if there's a second or a third mortgage or anything of that nature, liens or judgments, that all of those on title can actually be shorted and paid off in full at the time of closing, and also that debt is no longer follows that person. So in other words, there isn't any kind of deficiency judgment. Whereas if a person actually goes through foreclosure, and if they have that second mortgage or liens or judgments, then the first mortgage takes the property back, but now all of those deficiency debts are then following the people, and then those people then therefore usually have to file bankruptcy in order to get rid of that debt. So for a lot of us that are out there that are doing that type of work, we're basically you know, putting the people back on their feet and restoring their credit and so forth. And also many of us, too, will then also, you know, just ensure, too, that the people, you know, have a place to move to and so forth and are not left homeless. And so then from there, then we turn around. We're able to purchase the property basically from whatever the bank determines, because in a short sale process, it is the lender who actually determines what we will be purchasing the price, and we negotiate with the lender, and then we purchase it, then we increase the value. From that point, then it raises the value of the house, the neighborhood, and so forth, and you don't have vacant houses sitting on the market. And that's in a nutshell what we do.
My name is Mary Austin. I am president of the Northwest Real Estate Association, and I'm here tonight to do two things. One is to really suggest that this bill should not go anywhere, because while there is some really good points in it, there is some poor points in it. It is going to create more problems, more amendments, more changes down the road, and that continual spiral, I'm afraid, will continue and become problematic. The one thing that I don't like, there's many things in this bill. The one is the 20-day rule. I don't know where in the world you got a 20-day rule, which means that if a person is facing auction, that if they're at 20 days before auction, they can't get any help. And I don't understand that. And I brought with me today Greta Grace, who is one of the people that we brought, that called us 5 days before her auction. And we went in to her home, entered into an agreement with her, a short sale agreement, and contacted her lender, who postponed the sale because she had a valid contract, and we in fact were able to complete the sale. She avoided the foreclosure, and I would love for you just to hear from her.
Thank you. I appreciate you testifying, and I apologize for the shortness of the testimony. We may have another opportunity again, but I'd like to go ahead and give others an opportunity before we have to close.
Okay.
Thank you. Where was I? Greta Grace, Kathleen Jamal, James Lerman, and John Sheldon are the last people I have up. And again, if somebody's already said what you got to say, you can say you're opposed to the bill or in favor of it, whatever the case may be. If you'd introduce yourself for the record and give us a very quick testimony, if you could.
I can talk really fast.
Great.
My name is Greta Grace. Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
My name is Greta Grace, and as Mary Austin said, about a year and a half ago, my house was in foreclosure, and I just kind of was in denial. I didn't know who to talk to. I didn't know what to do. I was just really scared, and I think I was just waiting for someone to come on my doorstep and say, here's all this money, I'll save your house. So I didn't really do anything for a long time. About 1 month prior to the auction sale date, I thought I'd better do something. So I called my lender, and they said, oh, we can help you, don't worry. And they took some information over the phone, and I said, well, I only have 1 month till the sale date. Don't worry, we'll take care of it. My biggest concern was that they were going to eat up what valuable time I had left to do something. So after a couple weeks, they called me back and basically said there wasn't anything they can do. I just needed to come up with $26,000, and then my house would be out of foreclosure. Well, if I had that kind of money or could get it from somewhere, I would have already done that. So I was really terrified. I thought I was going to lose my home. Since my house went into foreclosure, I received many brochures and flyers in the mail from all different companies saying that they could help me. I kind of looked at them and just set them aside. After the mortgage company said they couldn't help me, I researched some of them. Mary Austin's company was one of them that I researched. The reason I called Mary was because they're a member of the Better Business Bureau. I researched them on the internet. I also heard them advertise on the radio. So I called her. I had 5 days till my sale date. They came out to my house right away, met with me, looked at my house, and basically did a short sale. So I avoided the deficiency judgment. I saved my credit from having an actual foreclosure. Everyone that I dealt with that works with Mary was very informative, honest, ethical. She explained everything to the T. I understood exactly what I was doing. The service that they provided for me and for other homeowners is invaluable, and they need to be allowed to continue to do this.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is James Lerman. Thank you very much for your time. I will speed read. From the lender's perspective, the investor plays a vital role in the loss mitigation process. Please understand that the last situation the bank and investor wants is another bank-owned property on their books. Estimates suggest that a lender loses an average of $50,000 to complete a foreclosure and sell a property, and they are required by law to insure every loan in foreclosure for 6 to 10 times the value of the mortgage. With over 15 months of inventory in our market and foreclosures climbing, they would much rather settle the debt and move on than to go through the foreclosure process and take another home back. They actually encourage homeowners to pursue short sales. In case you weren't aware, almost all major and minor lenders and mortgage servicers across the United States have departments set up and fully staffed to specifically manage these transactions. To support this point, please review the attached document pulled from Fannie Mae's website. I made copies for everybody.
Mr. Lerman?
Yes, sir.
Since you've provided written testimony, I ask that you not read it to us because we can all read it later on. So to just summarize real quickly, and I'm trying to discern that you're probably opposed or for the bill. So if you could, you know, just summarize real quickly so I can give another somebody else an opportunity to speak.
Yes, sir. From the lender's perspective, the short sale is a viable alternative to foreclosure. It's a viable alternative to having another bank-owned property on their books. Any ethical investor provides all the criteria that have already been requested. Paperwork, no promises or guarantees, no fees ever. All the things that any professional would request in providing a service, professional investors provide it. And we work together with lenders. Lenders determine the price at which a property will be sold. If, as Representative Matthews pointed out, it's a transaction that works, it works because the lender approves it, not because an investor and a homeowner arbitrarily sort of collude on a price. It's all up to the lenders, and the lenders approve and encourage short sales.
Thank you. I appreciate
Thank you. Brevity.
Well, I think I'm the odd duck here. I'm the distressed home counselor. And in that role, what I do is work with folks that are current today.
Can you identify yourself for the record, please?
Kathleen Jamal is my name from Milwaukee. Thank you. In that role, I work with folks that are think that they're and there's an imminent threat of default. Maybe they're current today, but their savings are soon gone, or they're in foreclosure. And I've had folks call me that it's a day before the foreclosure sale. And I've managed those shops in the mortgage environment for 35 years, so I'm very proficient at what I do. And 3630 and 3359. The things that's concerning to me is that the two roles, the investor that purchased the property where there may be a conveyance of property and the counselor's role seem to have merged into 3359. So it causes me as a counselor who has no intent of ever owning the property or having it conveyed to me with some reporting requirements and contracts and disclosures to the borrower that aren't relevant in a counseling situation. I also am a bit concerned with the language of trying to foresee what's going to happen 2 years from now, whether there's equity or not equity in a property. And I personally think that any property that's vacant the borrower doesn't intend to occupy should be exempt from this, or where the bank or any of the lien holders have accepted a short sale because it means there is no equity. So I would like to see that at least be an exemption, as any vacant property or anybody that does not intend to occupy the property be an exemption where there is no equity to protect.
Thank you. And I have one more person to testify real briefly. Thank you. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Yeah. Thank you. My name is John Sheldon. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson and the committee. I, too, am a member of the Northwest Real Estate Investors Club Association since 2001, very active member. I've been involved in over 200 transactions in that time since 2001. I also teach a monthly class on ethical and legal real estate practices. Over the years, I've helped dozens and dozens of distressed homeowners. And it's a great thing. Everyone is so happy when we end up buying their home and save them from these situations. And I'll try and summarize here. The homeowners are eager and grateful to find someone who will purchase their home and stop a foreclosure. And the realistic effect of this bill as written will increase foreclosures. It will likely decrease the value of properties and increase the rate of blight in some neighborhoods. We did stress the intent of the RIA, the Northwest Investment Members, and other investors who purchased is to assist the distressed homeowners in a foreclosure. The passing of the bill would preclude real estate investors from making a profit while assisting the distressed homeowner. If there's no incentive to do so, the logical and realistic result will be an increase in the foreclosures because the option will not be there. No further incentives will lead to more foreclosures, and less investors will be involved. Investors like us, we have the knowledge, financing, and marketing skills to put these houses back on the market for sale at a higher price, thus bolstering the local real estate values. And also, sometimes it would turn into rentals. And at a time like this, more rental housing is very important because of the displaced people falling out of their, because of bad loans and the overall housing market, but also because of the 12% unemployment rate we have here. So allowing investors to help the market progress improves property neighborhoods, brings local jobs and needed rental housing. Doing the opposite by passing HB 3359 as written and reducing the incentives for investors will do just the opposite, prolonging neighborhood blight, negatively affecting housing values, and increasing foreclosures, and importantly, the personal and financial miseries that accompany them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think you made your points a couple times, and so I'm guessing that I understand your situation and all that have come up to some degree anyway about what you do. And I guess, do you see that there's any room for, or should there be any room for some sort of ethics for people that operate in your venue, do you think?
Well, absolutely. There should be some controls.
So where are those ethics and law, and who oversees those?
As was stated earlier, we are not licensed.
No one's
asked us to be licensed, nor is there a vehicle for us to be licensed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that is an answer. There are in any industry, there are going to be some bad apples,
mm-hmm.
cars, and whatever it is. I'm just yeah. real estate, realtors, whatever. I don't know the best way, but to regulate them. But I'd be glad to participate in more discussions to help. But what I do know is, I addressed the committee on 3630 last year.
I remember.
Is most people, I believe, don't understand that over 95% of the people who are in foreclosure have zero equity in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're helping those people. And yes. It's not a hobby. We do, you know, it is our business.
Yeah,
and we have very high
ethics. I don't think anybody's disputing that business model, actually.
Okay, so, great.
I appreciate. I'm going to have to end.
Excluding
I'm past
short
my
sales
time.
And excluding
I really have
us
to
as buyers
on.
As consultants. That's really key.
Okay.
Thank you very much for
all
your
right.
time.
We'll have further conversations, I'm sure.
Thank you.
So thank you, committee. I'm sorry we ran over time, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3359. And with that, are we carrying anything, Larry?
No.
With that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Yes.